Okay, I think we're back.
At least for most people.
So first I'll ask if there are any announcements. Okay, well, I can start. First of all, as everybody knows, thank you very much, Karen, last week for facilitating this call, but the NAAAW abstracts are due tomorrow. And we will have a Climate Literacy Network abstract submitted sometime either today or tomorrow morning, depending on when I can get that together. the abstracts together, just anytime. The other thing I wanted to let everybody know is that we have two climate literacy sessions at the GSA meeting, and abstracts, the link for submitting abstracts to that is open. So I will be sending a formal email that lists these. But the two sessions, one is around educational activities in formal and informal educational venues, and the other one is on education and research around improving climate literacy. So we've limited the number of sessions there, but that's available. The actual deadline's not until August 14th, but it's open now, and those sessions have been accepted. And then the other new step in the AGU sessions, we have successfully submitted 8 session proposals on climate literacy for AGU. The deadline was Friday, and many of the people were at the tri-agency meeting. It was very well advertised there. I was quite pleased at the tri-agency organizing group, which some of you are on the phone, allowed that to be advertised in a very open way. And so we have 8 sessions, and the other point that I made there was that there's 26 conveners on those 8 sessions. So we got a nice broad range of people involved in forming those sessions, which is exactly what we want, to bring in a very broad community. And as soon as those sessions are accepted and the links are open, I will share the abstracts and the descriptions and session titles with everybody, along with the convener's name, so that people can start thinking about which sessions they want to submit abstracts to. So those are my announcements with respect to sessions that are going on. Are there any other announcements before we get to the other topics where
to sessions? Did any NSTA sessions going on that were ridiculously short turnaround or long?
Yes, I submitted 2 session proposals, so it would be worthwhile to find to have people send me. People did send me, and Karen, you, I don't know if you. If people send you a list of things that they submitted to NSTA also, did people send you that, or were you focused last week on?
No, we were. We just talked last week about AGU and NAAEE, and the list that I have sent out is just NAAEE, and in addition to those, there are, I don't know, 3 or 4 others. So I think the total for submitted for NAAEE is going to be somewhere between 8 and 10-ish. But I don't know anything about NSTA to answer Don's
question. Okay. I'll put out an email asking people to send me the links, but that's a good point. We submitted 1 workshop around a climate change curriculum and then another for a presentation for clean.
Yeah, and I submitted 1 on climate and energy, some variety. Blurs together now.
Did anybody else on the phone submit an NSTA abstract? Okay. Any other announcements? Okay, well, if not, then we'll move on to, there's actually a lot of suggestions for topics. Today we're going to, I think, focus on the 2 that I mentioned in the email. One is that, as most of you are aware, the tri-agency climate change education principal investigators meeting was last week. And what I thought I'd do is sort of give you an overview, at least from my perspective, of what happened there, and we have people who were actually on the organizing group on the phone, so they can offer their perspective, and any other people who attended offer their perspective also as to what happened. So just to give people an overview, the meeting started Tuesday evening with a keynote talk by Kathy Jacobs on the role of assessments, education, and adaptation in federal climate investments. It was really nice, at least from my perspective, to sort of have that brief meeting the day before things really got started, because it kind of brought everybody together, and it's a very nice networking opportunity. And then the next day was our marathon day. For me, it went from 8 o'clock in the morning to 7 o'clock at night. And we kind of got, as you'll see, a break the next day. But each morning, each agency had the opportunity to talk to their particular PIs. And so the first morning was the NSF awardees breakfast. And then we had a keynote panel, which was focused around using data and technology for climate education. And we had there was a panel which each gave a brief presentation, I think on the order of 20 minutes, one from NASA, one from NOAA, and one from NSF, about the kinds of tools around using data and technology that each of these organizations have. And I'll also mention here that eventually, I know it's not there yet, but eventually I think all of the presentations, the slides, will be made available on the tri-agency meeting website, and that's open to anybody to see. So I meant to share the link on the teleconference page, and I'll add that there. But right now, a lot of those pages are not working well, so no point in going there yet. But anyway, then there was a poster session, and since there were so many posters, and Andy, you may be able to say how many, but only one-third were in this first two-hour session on Wednesday morning. There's a two-hour session where people could network and learn about various projects. And then in the afternoon, we had concurrent workshop training workshops, which were along the lines of what the panel was in the morning. So the panel in the morning was about using data and technology for climate education. Then there were seven of these workshops in the afternoon. Each was 45 minutes long, we did two of them, so back to back. And there were seven, since I was part of one providing information about the Clean Effort and CAMEL, I didn't go to any. I didn't see any of the others. Those were well attended. At least from my perspective, those were well attended. We did run into trouble in the sense that we had structured the entire workshop about giving people the opportunity to explore the Clean and the CAMEL sites live in the context for which they had the most interest, and then the internet didn't work well, so people really couldn't do that. And then after that, there was a poster session again with a second third of the projects for 2 hours. And then after that, there was a share-a-thon in which people that had products that might not be explicitly in the poster sessions could share things that they had developed with people. So it was more than just posters. We were able to go live to the sites, and some people had hands-on materials. And there were two back-to-back share-a-thon sessions, and that brought us to the end of the day at 7 o'clock. Then the next day, we had another poster session in the morning for 2 hours, and then another keynote panel. And this time, the focus was on using insights from learning and social sciences to improve climate education. So that social science aspect, which is relatively new, but which we've embraced here on the Climate Literacy Network, and perspectives from those communities were brought in. So there were three talks there. Did somebody have a comment? No? Okay. One by Nancy Songer on climate change learning progressions. One by Sabine Marx on how perceptions of risk influence behavior. And one from Kathy Berry Bertram on the importance of cultural context, and her efforts are in Alaska. Then we had an optional event, the Earth, the Operator's Manual, which we've had presentations about on this call a few weeks ago. We got a little overview before their official unveiling of the film, or airing of the film. And then in the afternoon, we had the concurrent training workshops again, but this time around the content of the panel in the morning, which is the insights from the learning and social sciences. And so there were seven workshops then, and I was involved in discussions and did not manage to get to those. So if anybody has comments on how those workshops went, you can chime in. Anyway, so then after those workshops, that was 3:30, and we adjourned for the day. And what that really did is it provided the opportunity for all of the participants to really network in an informal kind of way, going off to different parts of Washington, D.C., and sharing thoughts with each other. So I thought that was really effective, even though it was really difficult the first day. Then on the last day, it was a half a day, we had another panel. Again, I should mention that the second morning, NOAA had their agency awardees breakfast, and then NASA had theirs on the third day, Friday morning. Then we had a keynote panel on the last day, the Science of Climate Change Impacts and Solutions, and we had four talks, one on climate change, the status of the science, as an update on that, and one on climate and health, one on climate change and the U.S. Navy, and one on solutions to climate change. So that really provided a nice context for, I mean, as we're always talking about, you know, instead of always the doom and gloom of what's going to happen, to provide that opportunity to think about how we might deal with it in a positive way. And then parallel to all of these discussions, the evaluators from the various funded projects, or a subset of them, were invited for a discussion to develop a common framework for climate change education evaluation. And that group shared their logic model during that during the end of that session there. And I think that we might have a broader presentation of that on the Climate Literacy Network and sometime in the coming weeks. And that is a summary of the meeting. I don't know, and there's a number of you on the phone who were there. Do you want to add anything or sort of give your perspective, maybe Andy or one of you from NASA, from the perspectives of people who organized it, as to how you felt it went overall, or if I left anything out?
Hi, Tamara. This is Andy.
Sure.
Okay. Sounds like you can. I wanted to just fill in a little bit of the blanks on the Thursday afternoon sessions, if you wanted me to.
Sure, go ahead.
I was a note taker for two of the sessions, and I believe Wynn's trying to gather all the materials, including the notes and that kind of thing, and they will be on that TRI-PI site for everybody to be able to see. But I attended a session on culturally relevant evaluations, and that discussion wound up centering on getting IRB approval for your evaluation tools. And so it got a little bit, you know, got a little bit crazy about how difficult that is. And then in the context of Native American Indian and reservation use and that kind of thing, and how difficult it can be to get those things approved. So there were suggestions on how to get that done and how you could use evaluation tools in those communities. And then the other one I went to was strategies for dissemination and scaling up. And that was kind of interesting. James Bray from American Meteorological Society had a lot of good suggestions in the discussion part, and all that stuff would be in my notes. So if anybody out there is interested in hearing about that, they can look for the notes on the Thursday.
Those will be posted on the Tri-Agency site along with the slides?
I think that's the plan, and there were note takers in all of the sessions from what I understand. I think the plan is, and that's why it's kind of taken a little bit of time to get the PowerPoints together with a copy of, you know, good copy of the notes. And so hopefully those will all be side by side, I think, eventually on the website. And
Yeah, I was wondering, because I have the slides from the session I led, and I can send them to you.
Okay, yeah, you can send them to me, and then I'll send them on. I think that, you know, there's a lot of work to get all of that, as you can imagine, together for,
yes.
You know, it was
it
really...
It is a lot of stuff.
A lot of stuff. And then I think you mentioned earlier about the number of e-posters, and I have no idea, because I know there's 71 NASA NICE projects, and I think, you know, almost everybody put in an e-poster, mm-hmm. and then I can't, you know, the numbers get even higher when you add the NSF projects and the NOAA projects. So it's probably at least 100 e-posters, I would guess.
Yeah. Okay, great.
This is Anne. I also just want to mention that on the meeting website, there's a link to a feedback survey. So anyone who's on the line who's at the meeting, we would really appreciate that input. Tamara, you mentioned that things didn't really work out that well in your room using with the internet access, and so that's the kind of thing that would be really helpful.
Yeah, I've actually already answered it and put all that in. So.
Great. So all of that is helpful in planning the next go-around.
So overall, from your some of the organizers of the meeting did, it, how did it go from your perspective? Did you see the engagement that you were hoping for?
I think so. It was really, it's really incredible to see all of the conversations that come together. I was in the evaluation strand basically the entire time, so I almost feel like I missed the meeting. But those conversations were really very valuable, and I was really pleased with how far we were able to get. And Andy might be able to speak more to how the rest of the meeting came together.
Yeah, I guess I would say the same thing for the rest of the meeting. I just saw a lot of people meeting other people that they could, you know, partner with and share resources and things. So I think that part of it was a great success, and we were hoping that there'd be enough time for people to mingle and get to know what else is out there that's going on that's similar to what they're doing. So I think it was definitely a success all around from my perspective.
Good. Okay, does anybody have any questions about the meeting, or is was anybody who's on the phone at the meeting that wants to provide their perspective?
As someone, this is Karen Holweg, as someone who was not there, I really like your idea, Tamara, of having a CLN phone session with about the assessment piece so mm-hmm. that all of us can learn more about what's being said about that. And I'd also like to know a little bit more about the learning panel session that you talked about.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, another thing that, go ahead.
I was just going to say, this is Scott, Carly here. Oh, and I'm just curious, almost more an atmospheric question. What's the sense of folks here that that there's a lot of, certainly that there's lots more work to do, but that there's actually going to be support from the federal government and sort of ongoing work? Or are we starting to see sort of a cranking down, or is this more of a building up of climate change education efforts? That's a tough question, I'm sure.
There's two answers. The sad part of it is that everybody's budget is going down. However, that being said, at least from the way I heard things there, is that the commitment of the people in the federal agencies that are involved with this is part of the reason for the tri-agency meeting is to leverage efforts, to allow the people who are doing climate change across the agencies to take advantage of what's going on, so to eliminate or reduce duplication of effort. So there's a definite commitment on the part of those involved in doing the funding that these efforts should go forward. That is going to happen in the atmosphere of reduced budgets. I was at two of the agency breakfasts in which the slide presentations talked about the various opportunities. And as you can imagine, the reason I didn't go into those in detail is while there's opportunities, those slides went back fast. By so fast, with and there was a lot to digest, and so I'm kind of waiting for those slides to appear, mm-hmm. so that we can sort of think about them a little bit more concretely. I know for the NASA, Carl Person, who is the head of MUREP, which is the program at NASA that under which the NICE program resides, talked about the reductions that they're dealing with, but he also chaired the panel that is organizing the their educational portfolio, and there's four strands, and I'm not going to get them all right, but we'll try here. One is on STEM, one is on professional development, one is on scholarships, fellowships, and internships, and one is on implement partnerships, I think.
Institutional engagement.
Institutional
higher ed organizations, that sort of.
Right. So, and I think the solicitation, the next solicitation from NICE is supposed to come out in the summer. Is that what I remember hearing? He said something about it. It's not out yet.
We're not sure. We can't speak to that right now.
Okay.
So, so that's, and then for NSF, I wasn't at the NOAA one. At NSF, they the CSEP-based two projects will hear in early June. Their grants won't be in place in early June, but people will know who is being, that whether or not they're going to be funded. And they have said this time that they will inform those who are not going to be funded right away, rather than waiting until they take care of all those that are going to be funded. So that's going to, and then there's other opportunities, which I remember Jill talking about this SEAS, which is Science, Engineering, and Education for Sustainability. And it sounded like that was an overarching program, but then people here at Turk handed me a solicitation called Arctic SEAS. So it might be, so again, I don't know all the details, and you can either go onto the NSF site and look up SEAS yourself now, or you can wait till the slides are available, because it kind of puts it in a little bit more of a context, and then, but there'll be opportunities available. The other thing, that's really all I can talk about, the funding. The other thing in terms of the tri-agency meeting, which I also, so Andy knows, I did put in, and Andy know, I put in my evaluation, was that this is a PI meeting for those projects in which each of the agencies is funding for what they consider their climate change education dollars. But I know that there are other projects being funded by each of these organizations that are relevant to this, and my biggest the biggest block that I know about, because I'm actually part of this other block, is that I have NSF funding for the DRK-12 program. That's a Discovery Research K-12 program. And while all of the projects obviously are relevant, mine's directly relevant to climate change education. It wasn't officially represented at the tri-agency meeting, but the DRK-12 PI meeting is going to be in June, and there's a list of about 20 environmentally relevant projects. And Karen Holwig and I have put together a session, which is accepted that meeting, to get this group together. And it would seem to me that identifying blocks of projects like this would be relevant to bring them into the tri-agency meeting venue, because, again, that allows the networking that can allow leveraging and reducing of duplication of effort. So we'll see how that plays out, but we will have an opportunity to talk to that group about these efforts. I will also obviously invite them to join the Climate Literacy Network too. But it seems to me it should be a venue that can be opened up. Yes.
This is Frank. Sorry for my lateness. But one of the important points about the tensions that the Tri-PI group are feeling is the size. They're feeling kind of on the large side right now. And one of the reasons why they haven't gone to the other grants that they know are of relevance, like the DRK-12, is because of if you start growing the number of PIs that come in, and the then it just becomes, you start losing the community. And so one of the things we were talking about was synergies between the logic model and the evaluation framework and the TRACS initiative. Because then multiple communities can see each other's work and collaborate where there's synergy without having to grow necessarily the PI meeting. Now, that may come down the road, but the community is very, very large. And that was kind of then there's the non-federally funded community, which is very, very large. And
Frank, what is the TRACS that you're referring to?
Trace. Trace is the Tri-Agency Climate Education Catalog. And so one of the things they're doing, I can send everybody to the link for this in just a second. But what they're trying to do here is they're trying to build a database that collects all the information about each of the projects, and in a way that would allow, down at the deliverable level. So if you're working on a professional development for K-12 teachers, and so on, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, you could put that information in, and then the question is whether or not how it's searchable is still under development, and people could start seeing what each other are doing in a more during the development phase. That was the general idea.
Mm-hmm.
And they were using that during the Tri-PI meeting. And so one of the points I was making to them is that the same database could be very valuable to expand to the wider community who are outside the grant set that are at the meeting, or even wider than the federal set, potentially.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do understand the tension between the size of a group and, at the tri-agency meeting. Totally understand that, but there's also no substitute for the advantages of having that informal networking like we did on Thursday afternoon.
Absolutely.
I just think that maybe we just need to think about a way that's a little bit less arbitrary than you got funded by these dollars and somebody else didn't, and that's how you make the line. That's just
right.
That seems really difficult to me.
So one of the points that was discussed in at least the NOAA meeting with all RPIs was the next round of this could be a PI meeting followed by a summit where the larger community meet, and the PI community are already there. So you're kind of doing two meetings in one, which is kind of what happened with the aquarium community meeting on Monday and Tuesday, then transitioning down to the interagency community on Tuesday evening through Friday. So it's a wider circle that you could meet the PI need, and then you could open it to a larger community somehow. That's one of the things that's in discussion.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is Carol Mandrick, and I just want to add that both within the evaluator strand and just a lot of conversations I had with people in general, there definitely is a desire to expand. People sitting at the tables aren't worried about size. They just wish that if we are trying to coordinate and not overlap and everything, it would be great to somehow include everybody in some manner.
Right.
Get input.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that we have here on the Climate Literacy Network, since nobody's traveling. It's open to anybody who wants to participate. And we do have 365 people on the teleconference listserv. And even though not everybody calls in every time, people tell me that they read the email. So they're, people are really engaged, beyond the 15 to 25 we have on the call every week.
One idea, Tamara, was to look at the Trace project as a kind of a way. I mean, we kind of did this with the projects on the community page, where we have who's doing what, but this is a little bit more finer resolution. And it's a complicated problem, but there might be a way of facilitating the community with a little bit more precision. I mean, obviously, that's work, and that means money and time. But it is a very large community, and there's a lot of work going on, and it's kind of hard to track.
It's important to address that because it is a large community. But the only way we're going to solve these problems is by being larger.
Right. Yeah. But we need tools to facilitate that larger community.
Exactly. I agree. Okay. Are there any more comments or questions about the tri-agency meeting?
This is Caroline. I'm intrigued by the discussion, and I think people wanting to be at the table seems to be valued by this crowd. And what I'm hearing everybody saying is maybe topic-centered is what we're trying to promote on these calls so that it's inclusive. But maybe some bigger chunks like formal education and informal education and then the crossroads or intersection of could be three big baskets to start, you know, having people think about.
Well, that's the way we've sort of divided up the AGU sessions, and then while we were, so originally we had seven sessions, and then we had somebody from one of the Phase One CSEPs really wanted to have a session focused around their regional network, which was the Great Lakes, and So here you have a case where one of the things we wanted to do with the seventh session was to make them distinct enough so that people would not be confused about where to submit their abstracts. That you know, it would be pretty clear, and that each session would have a cross section of different kinds of activities that address that particular community or topic. In the issue with the Great Lakes one, where we are piloting having one that's regional, is whether or not they actually get abstracts that go beyond their Phase One network, their CSEP Phase One network. And then my sense was that within that network, they're going to have abstracts that could be relevant to any one of the other ones. I mean, they probably have efforts in informal science, and they probably have efforts at higher ed, and they probably have efforts at K-12, and they probably have some research efforts. So they could potentially, all of their abstracts could potentially fit in the whole range of the other abstracts. So the question is, Caroline, related to what you brought up, is the question is, which way do you slice it?
I think it needs some time of thought. If you've cut it too small, it's irrelevant, and if you cut it too chunky, it's not workable. So I think putting some time and thought into creating these rippling communities of conversation that sort of overlap and then combine. And, we're doing the same thinking structurally at the Public Garden Association, and how to make a dialogue inclusive without it being too large to manage, you know.
Yeah.
Caroline, one of the interesting questions in this kind of conversation is how do these different modes intersect and relate to each other? So how does informal complement formal and formal complement informal? And, you know, where does lifelong learning happen? How does stakeholder engagement or outreach or media, I mean, how does this all work into the lifelong learning process for environmental literacy or whatever you want to call it? And that's where the segmentation sometimes gets a little stovepiped.
That's clearly where my passion is, because my idea of engagement to feed education is that if we don't cast a wider net, we're just skimming off the top 28% of society to teach and engage in. You know, there's a very deeper level that doesn't even know what carbon dioxide is. So, you know, I'm really sensitive to the intersection between the two and seeing successes when you find creative ways to bridge them.
Right.
So I would want to be at the intersection, but I don't know how to cut the I mean, what I do with this call is I find out what's happening that's exciting and optimistic, so that when I talk on public engagement, I can say here's the good news. There's this robust clearinghouse of peer-reviewed resources. There's this incredibly bright group of people talking weekly. There's summits being held at the... So I can celebrate the depth and breadth of good stuff that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, what I'm missing from being on these calls is some of that deeper dialogue, kind of what's coming up right now. And, you know, I don't know how to structure it. I just would like to play in it.
Right. One thing Tamara, did you mention the Earth, the Operator's Manual relaunch that was briefed to us?
Yeah, I mentioned that they had a session at the tri-agency meeting that was sort of an overview of when they were going to be launching it.
Right.
Well, I don't know if you wanted to add to that.
Well, just one thing that I think the network would really find valuable is the Jeff Haynes Styles, you know, passport for the future, I think, if that's right. I mean, mm-hmm. they've been really pushing this Earth the Operator's Manual, and they've kind of done a second version of it. And I think a lot of the storylines
that are... There's actually three shows. I mean, there's
three
Earth, Energy Quest and mm-hmm. Powering the Planet.
Oh, I see.
In addition to Earth the Operator's Manual. And
is that what it is?
Yeah, so there's three shows, Earth the Operator's Manual, Energy Quest USA, and Powering the Planet. I actually have in front of me the schedule of when they are going to be aired on in Boston. It's Channel 44. And I think he had it on his slides, but today is the 24th, and on the 27th, in East, it's going to be broadcast 5 a.m. Eastern Time and 11 a.m. Eastern Time. That's Earth the Operator's Manual. Energy Quest is going to be at 9 a.m., 3 p.m., and 8 p.m. Eastern Time on the 27th. Empowering the Planet is 10 a.m., 4 p.m., 6 p.m., and 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the 27th.
Wow. So, yeah. But, I mean, they've done some of the finest work, in my opinion, mm-hmm. In this area, and they've really blended a lot of the kind of the settling the science and saying, this is just not, you know, stop that, and mm-hmm. and let's move forward into solution frameworks that are really moving forward and at the scale that makes a lot of sense, which is between the personal and the international. You know, there's a lot of really rich work there that I think is worth exploring for our community. So,
you know, I'd like to agree. This is Carol Mandrick. I'd like to get back to something that Caroline said about, you know, she used the term skimming the surface and also depth. And I'm thinking about, okay, tri-agency getting large, but yet we want to include everybody else. And where I see a huge tension is between the formal and the informal communities, because a lot of the informal communities are like, yeah, okay, that doesn't apply to us, and vice versa. And obviously there's overlap, but there's huge areas where there isn't overlap. And I could see a value in having like a tri-agency plus others focusing on formal and another one focusing on informal, and, you know, acknowledging that there's overlap, but if you were totally focusing on formal at one entire day or one meeting, then you could get to the depth, because when we're trying to do everything, we only can be superficial.
The only thing I would add there is that one of the parts of the conversation I find is still really missing is the relationship between the two. That they, you know, usually in people talking about one or the other, they kind of, you know, weight their domain more than the other. And there's usually these little jabs that are put in, formal is better, informal is better, and it's not better, it's just that they're, but we don't really talk about the model for civic science literacy or environmental
right.
literacy. Like, how does a human being start from being born to dying, build literacy, and then once you understand that, then you can actually work along that continuum. And that's a richer conversation that rarely happens.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, and in my mind, the most problematic issues are the ones around the cultural, social kinds of elements, which are common to both formal and informal,
yeah.
and some of the assessment issues, too. And I think those cross both areas. So I think, for me personally, the deeper conversations are around topics that cross the boundaries of formal and informal.
I'm sorry, I was off on another call for a few minutes, so I missed some of this, but one of our Marcellus Shale grants, the one that I'm most involved in, is working across communities with formal and informal educators working together to try and figure out how to build Marcellus Shale literacy in particular, and energy and climate literacy more broadly. And so we're sitting down with groups of a dozen folks from schools, museums, colleges and universities, nature centers, and scheming together to try and develop programming. And we're making some progress there, I think, that does obviously cut across, or at least communicates between formal and informal. And it's been really rich discussions so far, but I, like I said, I did miss some of what's going on. So, but we're working on that. We're working on bridging that formal-informal divide.
You know, it would be really neat if on a future one of these calls, we could have people like the two people who just spoke give examples of what they're doing to address those different intersections, and we just have that be the topic of one of the calls.
Mm-hmm. I'd be glad.
But bridging informal and informal.
Yeah. Somebody
and
else.
I think that's a good idea. And I will mention that in putting together the AGU sessions, the other connection that was mentioned was the connection between secondary and higher ed, which is not usually addressed. But that's the same kind of tension sometimes.
Well, we've got it going on in the same
they're in
room.
One or the other, but addressing both.
Yep.
Yeah, I missed last week's call because we had one of these workshops where actually our first and second cohorts met, and it was very interesting, the conversations between community college faculty and local high school faculty who had never really talked for one time. And
yeah,
the
we
community
have an
college
example
faculty
of that here.
Recognizing
the we have
community
an example
college
here,
faculty
yeah.
recognizing that they weren't getting the worst students from high school.
We have an example of a kind of connection being made here at the University of Massachusetts Lowell between the college programs and the high school programs in an informal setting. It's a summer program for high school students. So that's another example. So we could put together a session that kind of talked about examples of that kind of effort.
This is exactly what I do. This is Caroline. And, you know, the Fairchild Challenge and the CLIO Project are intersections of formal and informal and do the scalable stuff that we're talking about. So just keep in mind, we got some on-the-table models. The Fairchild Challenge in particular was feeding a pipeline from high school to college and internships and interests and kids coming back and wanting to do that. The CLIO Project has a youth task force of college and high school kids. So I came from formal education. I was a high school teacher and principal, landed in a public garden, and started creating programs that cultivate that fertile ground between the two. And while I think the person who spoke earlier about needing to keep them separate for deep, robust, content-driven stuff, we have to capitalize on each other's strengths to showcase the good work that we're doing. I won't have any integrity in what I'm saying without the hard science behind it. So I just want to throw that out there, that there are excellent working models about bringing together communities to bridge that divide so that you don't even know where the learning begins or ends in informal and formal. And you have formal education, people hosting informal learning forums and so. So I'm excited to hear everybody saying this and pulling together teams. I think it's really the only way to get this cultural divide bridged. And this cultural divide we have here in Miami is the microcosm of future America. And we got to get the voters understanding climate change so they can turn the corner on fossil fuels. So without a voting public that's informed, we keep hearing this nonsense. So I say have at it, please. Find the informal science centers willing to work with you all and blow open that intersection.
So, Tamara, have we ever done a panel discussion on the Climate Literacy Network?
I don't think we have. I was just thinking about that. That's a format we haven't used.
Because I would imagine if we pulled together a panel discussion and then it's a standard format. I would imagine we need longer than an hour to do it justice. Because if we get something rolling, let's not and we'll fill it in on the email. I think a little bit of scheduling here could do some rich work.
Yeah. No, I think it's a good idea. What I'll do is I'll send out an email to the list as a whole asking people who might be interested in contributing to such a panel discussion, and then have a smaller email conversation with those who express interest and put together such a session. And we can schedule it for longer than an hour. We haven't done that often because we're aware of people's time constraints, but we could give people enough notice that they might think about.
And
we'll, of course, record it so others can hear it if they're only able to chime in for an hour.
Sure. Well, I mean, maybe one way to do it is just to schedule the hour and then have a follow-on optional discussion time. If people have the wherewithal to keep on going, they can, and if they don't, then they drop out, and it would be recorded.
Yep,
it would be recorded so they could come and listen. We can even tell them at which minute they
stop it. Well, I would welcome that because I think we have, I've said it before, we're on the edge of glory. We've got to find a way to get to that, you know, place where the sweet spot is.
Because I think there may be interest. I think we should pilot, we should do this with this particular topic, and then if it goes well, to try to pilot it with that other intersection, which is between secondary education and college.
Absolutely.
Right. Absolutely, yeah.
And on the secondary one, I mean, there's so much work in this area. That's one of the largest communities that we don't have really well represented is, you know, all the president's climate commitments, the 674 current members, they all are working on curricular stuff, less so than infrastructure work. But, I mean, there's some really rich models for how to do this at the undergraduate, graduate level that just, you know, they're not part of these conversations.
Right.
Is David Blockstein's Environmentals, is that one not bridging high school and college?
No, usually it's
his is
college.
Usually
deans and directors.
Undergraduate level.
Yeah.
Right. Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a really important boundary community to look at because it's even though it's still informal, I mean these steps along, say formal, do get broken, and the tethering between them is just not strong enough yet, and then crossing between formal and informal and family and other communities. Anyway,
I think this is really worthwhile pursuing, and because obviously we've just identified the intersections of activity that we're most aware of and may have the most need, but there's a lot of other ones, and we might be able to put together some panels for those also in the future. Okay, so we have just a few more minutes, and I did want to make everybody aware of, I mentioned it in my email and sent the links to, for the tri-agency meeting, we unveiled the new clean community page, which is a reorganization so that it's clearer where people go, and we integrated the Climate Literacy Network onto that page. And so I just wanted to let people know that that's happened. If you go to the Clean Community page, you'll see a nice little box there that says the Climate Literacy Network. And this page has been reorganized. The pages beyond that still need some work. So on the Clean Community page, there's a link to the Climate Literacy Network, which right now has all of the information that was on the Climate Literacy Network website, including a link to the Climate Literacy Network website. But we may want to reorganize this to make it more useful. So I would welcome input from people about what they think about this page. There also is on the Clean Community page a direct link to the teleconference page, which is somewhat reorganized from the past so that it's just not quite such a long list. Again, input from all of you on if there are pieces of the Climate Literacy Network site that you use that we haven't made obvious, let us know. anyway, so we're working to merge these two. So on the Clean Community page, you can find sections now. One for educators and learners, which has links to the workshops and webinars we have, the announcements list, which is different from the Climate Literacy Network list, links to our pedagogical scaffolding for teaching about climate and literacy and energy. Then there's a separate section for resource developers to provide them information about how to suggest their resources to be reviewed, to look at our gap analysis, which shows you where there are areas of our collection that we don't have many resources addressing particular climate literacy, essential principles, or energy literacy principles. and links to information about the review process. And then there's a section for everyone where the event calendar will be. There's also a link there to the Clean Partners, and this is a relatively new section. We're linking to those partners in which we right now it's those that we have an active involvement with in terms of being being part of the CSEP Phase 2 funding. And then we have a link to that archive of project climate change education project descriptions. It's here that would make the most sense that if we were to be able to access the
Trace
archive, that would appear here, where people could go and find information about other projects.
Yep.
And then on the main community page, in addition to the Climate Literacy Network, we have a section directly linking to what the review process is, so that's all open and people can look at it and engage us if they're interested in our in reviewing their resources. So that's our reorganization in general. Let me know what you think, if you have any thoughts about it or there's things that do or don't work for you here. I'd appreciate both Scott and I. Scott's helped quite a bit with this reorganization.
That's nice.
It's kind of a work in progress. It sort of reminds me of creating a new road. You know, well, the old road has to be operational. So there's a few detours.
Yeah.
But we'll fix it.
I like what you've done. I just have one quick question. It seems to me at one time we had access to a list of the people and their institutions that were part of the Climate Literacy Network. Does that still exist or not?
We actually have not had, we don't have that. I shouldn't say it. It's not something that's live. I have a list. Basically, the way this has evolved is that people became members of the Climate Literacy Network by asking to be on the listserv. And for up to the first 50 people, is all we were doing was adding them to the list, and it became apparent to me that we would like their contact information and affiliations. Mm-hmm. And so I started a separate contact list, but it's not open to the public because people don't always want their information kind of mm-hmm. out there. And there's 365 people on this list now. So, no, it's not
the reason
public.
The reason why I thought of this is as you were talking about in an era of constrained resources, the need to collaborate more and be more efficient about what we do, I said, yeah, and we need to know who the 300 and some odd are to be able to do that. And I totally appreciate what you're saying about not making everything public to everybody. So maybe that's something we need to think a little about and see if there's something in
between. When we were a small group, it was a whole lot easier because I could send out an email and say, do you agree to be on this public list? Now that there's quite so many people, it basically, even at the point that we decided we would keep a contact list and I sent out emails repeatedly, not everybody responded. So people that were early members who have not asked to be taken off, I might not have their contact information. Now we're pretty rigorous. Somebody asks to be on the list, we add them to the contact list also, which I have and is not posted anywhere. The other possibility is that we could have a password-protected section. And
right.
I think that's what we had at one point. And what that could do for us is that if people we could ask Sean, I think that this is pretty easy to do. The question mm-hmm. so we just need to I would put everybody's name who's on the list in that private section, but I wouldn't automatically give everybody who's on the list access unless they asked for it.
Okay.
And by the process of asking for it, they'd have to agree that their information would mm-hmm. be open to anybody who was on that list. So that's a possibility if people are interested in pursuing that. We could have on the Climate Literacy Network page a small private area where you have to log mm-hmm. in. And mm-hmm. to get that access, I would just have to give permission for that to happen.
Can I make a suggestion here? One thing I've always wondered is why we don't take advantage of some of the other tools that are out there, like the LinkedIn. I don't know how many people of that 300 and plus are in LinkedIn, but you know, they have a lot of tools in LinkedIn. That's, I mean, you could make your own group. There's one called a networking group, and you know, it's there's a lot of functionalities here that we could take advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
That I think is a better path than trying to solve it all on our own.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just put it out there as that, you know, we could create our own LinkedIn group, and there's a lot of turning things on and off. That, you know, we could do it. It's just not
so if we were to move in that direction, would that move conversations from the listserv, which a lot of people appreciate reading but don't really use, would that move conversations from the listserv to that?
I mean, these are open questions, but I just think there's some efficiencies of tools that we just don't, that we don't have right now. It's also a way of being a more inclusive community, because there's a lot of people in this community that are probably would want to be part of us.
Because I know that we actually have that. Another place to do that is in Facebook, because you can have a private group in Facebook also.
Sure.
Right.
Let me explore that. I have somebody here I can ask about this.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's a good idea.
In LinkedIn, I mean, but in LinkedIn, one of the things, so Karen is asking for contact information. Would you then, can we, like, put phone numbers and stuff, or is that not advisable?
I don't know. Well, in LinkedIn, there's a, you have to be part of the network, and you have to, you basically opt in, and you can put all the information you want to put in there. The individual user makes all those choices. So if you are in LinkedIn and they're in LinkedIn and you're both part of the group, that's how you find each other. You can get emails via LinkedIn. I mean, I think we don't need to talk about all of it, but it's really the individual chooses at what level they want to put their information out there. And I think that's probably a better posture anyway.
Yep.
Well, that's true. I guess, but like I would like people – like if we were to do this for the Climate Literacy Network, I would like people to have my phone number and stuff, but I wouldn't want any friend I had in LinkedIn to potentially have that. Can you narrow it down so that it's just within a certain community that people can get that kind of information?
Sounds like you have somebody to talk to. I don't know. Maybe.
Okay.
Good.
All right, very good. Well, we are at 2 o'clock Eastern Time, at least, at the top of the hour. Are there any more comments or questions for this week? Okay, we will follow up with potentially putting together a panel, and we also will follow up with sharing the information about the logic model from the tri-agency meeting when those who are working on that are ready. We will schedule a time for them to sort of give an update on that. Okay. All right, everyone. Well, thank you very much, and we will talk next week.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.